Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what a new group of elected officials in Maricopa County could mean for elections here.
And a Phoenix group is creating community for the fat babes of Phoenix. We'll hear more about that.
But first, Arizona voters overwhelmingly approved a measure to allow abortions up to about 24 weeks in Arizona in November when they passed Proposition 139. It marks a major expansion from the 15-week abortion ban that has been in place in the state since 2022. But when will the new law actually take effect? Well, Arizona's courts must weigh in on that now, and a lawsuit was filed this week to clear it up. And as litigation begins, some abortions beyond 15 weeks are resuming in the state. KJZZ's Catherine Davis Young is covering it all and joins us now to talk more about it. Good morning, Katie.
Hi there.
Okay, so let's start with this lawsuit. Sounds like lots of folks have been waiting for this.
Right. So Proposition 139 enshrines the right to abortion in the state constitution, and it allows abortions to the point of fetal viability, which is around 24 weeks, and it makes broad exceptions beyond that when there are health risks involved. But that new constitutional amendment doesn't automatically remove this other 15-week law from the books. So backers of Prop 139 anticipated all along that there would have to be a series of lawsuits to clarify which of the state's abortion laws can be enforced now that we have this new amendment to the state constitution. And they feel like the 15-week law is pretty clearly at odds with the new amendment, but they want the courts now to weigh in to just make that official.
Interesting. Okay, so this did not automatically go into effect, but we expected this to happen. Tell us more about this lawsuit. Who's suing?
So on the lawsuit, the plaintiffs are a pair of Arizona OBGYNs that are bringing the lawsuit along with Planned Parenthood Arizona, and they are all represented by the ACLU.
Okay. The lawsuit names the state of Arizona as the defendant. That would be someone represented, right, by Attorney General Chris Mays. But she's not obviously going to defend the 15-week law here. She's been very pro Prop 139 all along. So who is?
Right. That's the tricky part. So, yeah, right. Chris Mays is supposed to be the one representing Arizona in lawsuits against the state. But like you said, she's been a vocal supporter of this abortion rights amendment all along. So she's not going to be defending this 15-week law, but someone else could still step in. And actually, if you think back to the case this spring where the state Supreme Court was deciding whether or not to put in place that 1864 near total abortion ban, that was a very similar situation. Chris Mays wasn't the one arguing for the 1864 ban. So instead, it was the Yavapai County attorney, along with a director of a group of anti-abortion crisis pregnancy centers in the Phoenix area. Those two stepped in on that case. They call them interveners. It's just someone with an interest in defending that law. So something similar now could happen with this new 15-week law. Someone could step in to defend that.
All right. Well, yet to be seen. Okay. So now that there's a legal challenge, Katie, the attorney general can put the 15-week law on hold, essentially. How much does this change things for people seeking abortions in Arizona right now? We mentioned that some post-15-week abortions will resume.
Right. I did check in with Planned Parenthood. They're the largest abortion provider in the state. They are in the process of resuming those post-15-week abortions right now. They've had those on pause for about 2 years. That's because Chris Mays filed what's called a stipulation, where she basically says, as long as this case is in court, the state shouldn't be enforcing the 15-week law. So she says abortion providers can go ahead and start performing abortions beyond 15 weeks again.
Okay, so this is a big and kind of significant step in that sense. And it sounds like, Katie, this will not be the end of it, right? Like, there are a lot of other abortion restrictions on the books in Arizona based on various laws that have been passed over the years that we should also expect challenges to, it sounds like.
Exactly. Yeah, we've got dozens of abortion regulations in Arizona. There is a law that bans sending abortion medication through the mail. There is a requirement that patients have to wait 24 hours between their first appointment and the procedure. There's a requirement that patients have an ultrasound, which is not always medically necessary. So all those regulations may now be in conflict with this new constitutional amendment, but the courts will have to be the ones that interpret that, and that's going to take a bunch of separate lawsuits.
So it sounds like this could take a long time.
Yeah, it's probably months or maybe years more of abortion-related conflicts in Arizona courts, I would think.
That's interesting. So until abortion laws are really completely settled here. Okay, should we then expect these lawsuits to prevail, Katie, especially the one that was just filed this week that makes these big changes for us?
Abortion rights supporters are very confident. They say they specifically crafted this amendment in such a way that these restrictions would not be enforceable. But there are, passionate parties on both sides of this issue. There are people who are going to try to defend these laws, I'm sure. So I think we can expect a lot of conflict over these issues. These will be hard-fought cases, I'm sure.
So even though voters passed this by over 60%, right, it doesn't mean that abortion laws will be completely settled right away here in Arizona.
The courts will still have to weigh in on everything, yeah.
Yeah, okay, lots to watch for, and Katie Davis-Young will be covering it all for us. KJZZ's Catherine Davis-Young, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. Along with Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody. We are on day three of a three-day year-end new member drive. We hope you'll take just a couple of minutes this morning to support the kind of news coverage you get every single day here on KJZZ, the kind of news coverage you get every single day here on the show, conversations like Lauren just had with our own Catherine Davis-Young about what's next in the abortion landscape here in Arizona, the initiative, not the end of the story. We hope you'll give in support of that to keep that coverage coming your way every single day. You can make your gift online at kjzz.org. You can text the word donate. We'll send the form directly to your smartphone. Text to 888-774-9150. You can also call that number, 888-774-9150.
Want to send a thank you out to Nishi in Chandler, who came in at $30 a month. One of the things we love about that $30 a month level is it's just a dollar a day. And think about the fact that you can't even get a cup of coffee for a dollar a day. You can't really get a cup of anything for a dollar a day, except news, information, engaging, nuanced conversation on your public radio station, KJZZ. So if that matters to you, if that's worth a dollar a day to you, or anything you can afford, please visit us at kjzz.org or by calling 888-774-9150.
Speaking of a cup of coffee, I'm not sure if Nishi is a coffee drinker, but they'll be the recipient of a KJZZ The Show tumbler, so look out for that. If you would like to be the recipient of a KJZZ's The Show tumbler, you have just a little bit of time, about 43 minutes or so, to make that gift. Your gift also this hour will be doubled. Help keep these member drives short when you give during these hours when there are opportunities to make your public radio dollar go twice as far. KJZZ.org. Call or text the word donate to 888-774-9150.
And don't forget that when you donate at that $10 a month level, you're not just going to get the tumbler, you're also going to get a ticket to Zoo Lights at the Phoenix Zoo, which is just a really cool experience. There are incredible visuals, there's music, there's delicious treats. We're talking cozy s'mores pits, we're talking hot cocoa, there's a 200-foot light tunnel, you can get your photo with Santa. That is all yours, plus the tumbler, when you contribute at that $10 a month level. KJZZ.org or 888-774-9150.
Not to mention, all of that is terrific, especially the hot chocolate part. I know I'm sort of stuck on that this morning, but that all is terrific. But you're also knowing that you are doing your part to invest in a service that you depend on, that you enjoy, that you appreciate, that you learn something from, that benefits your life and the life of this community. When you make a gift of $5 or $10 a month or $20 or $25 a month, you're saying, yeah, I believe in public radio. I don't just listen to public radio and enjoy it and learn stuff from it. I'm investing in it. I believe in it enough to invest in its future. That is how public radio works. There are no commercials here on public radio. We have you instead. It is the way that we think is the best way to do this. It does, however, mean that we have to come to you during these member drives to ask for your support. We hope to hear from you during this very short year-end drive right now. Have your gift doubled when you go to kjzz.org. Call or text the word donate to 888-774-9150.
And Mark, you know, you said it earlier, the abortion proposition, the passage of it was not the end of the story. The story continues. And the conversation you just heard Lauren have is a part of what you can expect here on the show. The unfolding, ongoing details, nuance, and context that help you make sense of life in our state and our community. And also, as Mark just said, this is a perfect moment to donate. If you've been waiting, this is your hour. This is the time, because right now your gift will be doubled dollar for dollar, up to $1,500 when you support KJZZ with a donation. Why not make a sustaining donation? Why not make sure that the story never ends on your radio dial? Go to kjzz.org or call 888-774-9150. And thank you.
KJZZ is supported by Signify Business Cash by Wells Fargo. With this business credit card, cardholders can earn rewards on business purchases with no caps or categories to track. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/signify. Terms apply.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Elected officials in Maricopa County have generally been on the same page over the past few years when it comes to elections. They've defended the county's administration of elections and pushed back against conspiracy theories and disinformation coming out about them. But the County Board of Supervisors will include three new members come January: Debbie Lesko, Kate Brophy McGee, and Mark Stewart. A new recorder, Justin Heap, will also take the oath of office. And some of these new elected officials have been among those questioning elections in Maricopa County in the past. With me to talk about what this could mean going forward is Jen Fifield of VoteBeat, who wrote about this. And Jen, is there an expectation that with new supervisors and a new recorder coming in, that some of these officials may no longer be on the same page when it comes to elections?
Definitely. They even have labeled it one Maricopa, where they all respond, you know, in a united way. They defend one another currently, and it's through their mutual trust, I believe, they've built with themselves and also the elections department. They all know a lot about elections at this point. And I think that's the biggest change here, is that we have new people coming in who have said that they want to look at changes and want to ask questions and want to understand the system. And that might mean questioning the system in public too.
Well, and to your point, I mean, there are at least a couple of people who are coming in who have been, if not outright election deniers, maybe let's call them election skeptics.
Yes, especially our new recorder, Justin Heap. He has called the county's elections a laughingstock multiple times. He has said that the voter rolls are dirty, that they need to be cleaned up. He has talked about how there's been long-term staff there hired under radical Democrat Adrian Fontes, who was the recorder at the time. Now he's our Secretary of State. And so Heap definitely wants to come in and make some changes. On the Board of Supervisors, Mark Stewart and Chandler has also said that he thinks that the mistakes from 2022's election should not have happened. There need to be changes to processes. So at least those two have talked about some pretty wide-scale changes.
Has the new recorder, Justin Heap, has he said specifically what he would like to do, or are we able to look at maybe bills he sponsored or voted for or against in the legislature as hints for what he might look to do?
He hasn't responded to any of my calls since he started running.
Okay.
But looking at his legislative record, like you said, he introduced bills to do better ballot tracking. They call it chain of custody, where you're tracking where each ballot goes. That was shut down twice, bills on that topic. He wanted, he supported all of the bills to end early voting, to bring us back to precinct-based voting, not have where you can vote anywhere in the county. But his role will be limited here. So it's not like he can come in and just overhaul the system. A lot of this belongs to the supervisors and is under their authority.
Well, and as you write, the sort of the deal between the supervisors and the recorder as to who does what and who's responsible for what has changed over the past few years, including fairly recently. But you report that it wouldn't be a huge shock to see that agreement reopened and maybe reworked again with the new supervisors taking office and the new recorder.
I think it's almost guaranteed that they're going to get in there and work on this agreement they have on who does what. Now, whether they're going to, a majority will agree on changes. For example, the Board of Supervisors took away from the recorder things like managing the drop boxes, which, as you know, have been controversial ballot mm-hmm. drop boxes in the state. So that's something they took away from the recorder within the last year or so. And things like that might be where, you know, Justin Heap comes in and says, you know, I'd like control over that. And then it's all about negotiating and seeing if they can get a majority to agree.
All of this is so interesting in the sense that we haven't really seen the denialism and the claims of elections being rigged to nearly the same extent we've seen over the last two cycles, especially in Maricopa County. I'm wondering how folks either coming in or have been working for the county for a while, like how do they see this moment in terms of, you know, where we are in terms of people having faith in elections relative to who might be coming in and the changes they might like to make?
Well, I know a few people have joked with me that, you know, that elections are fair now, don't you know? You know, just kind of joking off of how Trump won and now people are less concerned about elections. But I think there's an underlying uncertainty and voter mistrust still that exists here across the state that isn't going away and that will need, you know, I think that the supervisors will still have that leverage to make changes when they're hearing from voters about, you know, how they don't trust the current system.
The county obviously does a lot more than elections, right? Like there's county budgets and all sorts of other agencies within Maricopa County. Do you get the sense or has anybody suggested that now that maybe the feeling of mistrust in elections has simmered down even just a little bit, might that allow the supervisors to get back to some of the other stuff that they're responsible for and really focus on that as opposed to just really dealing with elections for as much of their time as it seems like they've had to deal with that?
I think that's actually been the thought for 4 years now. When are we going to get back to this stuff? You know, we had after the audit where they reviewed the 2020 election, they thought, oh, we'll get back to it. And then Carrie Lake and her claims started coming around. And then it was back to the 2024 cycle. I think we'll see a lull here. We'll be able to act on like the new transportation tax and, you know, some of their priorities coming from a business perspective and trying to look at like the tax rate and all that. I think there'll be an opening here for a little bit, but who knows once the, you know, the new cycle starts back up.
Right. Does it seem as though there might be areas of agreement between the recorder and the various supervisors in terms of things that can be done to improve elections that they all might be able to actually agree on?
One thing for sure is the speed of election results. Four of the five supervisors I spoke with, and also we know Justin Heap, are interested in speeding up how long it takes to get results, whether that's working with state lawmakers to change the law, like the counting timeline, or doing things internally too, to add staff, add machines, add different things to get results faster.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the early pre-filed bills at the legislature was about doing away with the so-called late earlies and requiring people who are turning their early ballots in past a certain point close to the election day to show their signature when they drop it off to try to speed that process up, that same goal that you were just talking about.
Yeah, there's a few different ideas. One is having, you know, the voter show their ID and when they get there with their early ballot instead of letting them drop it off and having to review that signature later. And one is just not allowing them to do that at vote centers, which would be a big change. And our governor has not been supportive of that yet, but we'll see how it shakes out. There's lots of stuff coming up in the legislature.
Sure. All right. That is Jen Fifield with VoteBeat. Jen, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning to you. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I am Lauren Gilger here along with Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, and we are in the midst of the final day of this very short KJZZ year-end new member drive. This is when we remind you how public radio works. We are a nonprofit news organization. We only exist because listeners like you support it. Most of our financial support comes from listeners, believe it or not. And we don't answer to the demands of advertisers or profit margins or ratings. This is nonprofit here. So what we rely on is you. We answer to you, the public. So we need more of you now to join in and do your part. Lots of incentives to give, not the least of which is feeling good about doing something good for your community. But also we have a $1,500 member match this hour until 10 a.m. We're about halfway through that. We need more of you to call 888-774-9150 and have your gift doubled, or head to kjzz.org and have your gift doubled. So now is the time to do your part and do it now.
That's right, Lauren. And you know, I was just thinking, the conversation Mark just had with Jen Fifield, Jen is a somewhat regular voice here on the show, and the granularity and the attention to detail that she brings to her reporting is exactly the sort of thing that your contribution to KJZZ makes possible. The ability to find folks like that and get them on the air to put your life and your world in context. That is what public radio excels at, and it happens because of you, the public. So please head over right now to kjzz.org or call us at 888-774-9150.
We are able to bring you this kind of news, these kinds of conversations, to bring you conversations that bring context to the headlines because of you. So we're asking you now to join in with a financial contribution, $5, $10, $15 a month, whatever amount fits your budget. It goes a long way. And in fact, right now it will go twice as far because we have this $1,500 member match available from our member matching fund. For the next half an hour, have that gift doubled. Show your support for local journalism here in our community and on the show. And by the way, if you get in at that $10 a month sustaining level, we will also send you a KJZZ The Show tumbler for your morning coffee or beverage of choice. And you know, nothing will make you look smarter, right?
That's right. And if you're Mark Brody and you're putting hot chocolate in your tumbler, there's no judgment here. You can put whatever you want in that thing. Pens, maybe you don't want to drink out of it. You want to just show off your fountain pen collection. That's the kind of thing that you as a public radio listener probably are into, right? Look, KJZZ depends on sustaining members. Sustaining members provide KJZZ with a reliable stream of funding that allows us to spend less time on member drives like this one and more on bringing you conversations like the ones we've been having on the show this morning. These are conversations and context that you count on every day. So support your community news station, maybe at just $5 a month at kjzz.org or call 888-774-9150.
KJZZ is your source for news from the nation, the world, yes, but also from the valley, from across the Southwest, from our state capital, from Maricopa County, which we just heard Mark talk about with Jen Fifield. This is the kind of news coverage that hits home, literally. This is stuff that's happening in our backyard, in our community, in our democracy. If you appreciate that kind of coverage, if you listen to us because you want to hear what's happening here in our community, we're asking you to do your part to show your support for it. $10 a month will get you that KJZZ's The Show tumbler, and you will also have your donation doubled. So head to kjzz.org now or call 888-774-9150. And we thank you so much. Good morning. It is The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Launched in 2021, Mother Tongue Magazine is a biannual print magazine which, according to its founders, aims to explore the nuances of mothers' lives. In particular, the ways that motherhood intersects with art, sex, pop culture, politics, and, as the founders put it, a few things in between. It is that last category that writer Rachel Yoder chose to focus on for her recent Mother Tongue essay, A Matter of Time. The piece was inspired by a series of conversations with her young son about keeping track of every minute of every day. Yoder writes that his fixation on how much time he has left prompted her to reflect on the, quote, particular gift of motherhood, the ability to hold both life and death in a single body, the ability to see reality while also finding space to hope. I talked to Yoder about her essay recently, and she told me that when she and her husband first discussed starting a family, he was skeptical. Why, he wondered, would they bring a child into a world he viewed as doomed by an inevitable climate crisis? Yoder says that didn't make any sense to her.
It just sort of struck me as so alien and so outside the purview of how I had been thinking about having a child, because to me it just seemed so physically and obviously good and hopeful. And I do think that that's one of the gifts of motherhood, the sense of utter capability.
Yeah. And yet it stands in such contrast to the other feeling that you write about in this piece, which is the magnification of your awareness of the clock running out, and the sense that you can't outrun the clock running out. And in fact, you even talk about attempting to, as you put it, avoid the constant shoulder tap of death. What was your relationship to that feeling prior to the birth of your son? Was it something you fixated on, or was having him an experience of intensifying that awareness?
I mean, I think I went through an episode of really thinking a lot about death, as many people do during adolescence. Mm-hmm. And after that, sort of did the thing also that many of us do, which is where I just tried to forget it. You know, I got on with life. There were a lot of other things to think about. And now, as someone in middle age, I mean, it strikes me that that's the fundamental uncertainty of life, right? Is where and when and how, and we never know when we're going to reach that moment of death. And so how do we then parent in that shadow of uncertainty? How do we live joyfully in that shadow of uncertainty? I mean, that seems to be the big question.
Yeah. But one remarkable approach it seems like you're taking is, there's this beautiful scene where you're watching a movie on the couch with your son. Can you tell us the question you felt moved to ask him?
Sure. I wish I could remember what movie it was we were watching, but something in the movie sparked this impulse in me to turn to him and say, "Hey, when we're both dead, if there is any way that we can reach each other, that we can connect, that we can communicate, let's try our absolute hardest to do that, because, you know, you're who I would want to connect with more than anyone." And he sort of had this flash of panic, as one might expect, wash over his face, but then he got it, and we did a pinky swear, and we said, "We'll find each other." And there was something actually really comforting and lovely about that. And I think it also kind of speaks to this sense of utter capability when it comes to motherhood, that, you know, maybe we will be able to connect.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the unknown elements of all this, the way that you open the essay is by talking about this preoccupation with time that your son started to develop. And he always wanted to know exactly what time it was. And he always wanted to know how many minutes were left, you know, before you leave the house, how many minutes until you get home. Did you have a sense from the way that he was fixated on measuring time that he might have some kind of preternatural awareness about all this? Or was it more that the way that he was measuring time sort of rhymed with the concerns that you were having as a mother of magnifying this focus on death?
I knew that he was always a little worried about everything. And I think, you know, time provided a kind of certainty or boundedness. And it did. I identified it as like, oh, your brain is doing something right now, and it is needing to make sense of what we cannot see. Mm-hmm. I do think also of spirituality as a kind of intelligence, you know, in the same way that there's sort of like physical intelligence or intellectual intelligence, and that maybe some people are more sensitive to sort of the forces that move between and among us.
Yeah. You know, you're talking about spirituality as a form of intelligence, and so much of spirituality is founded on storytelling traditions and like the accumulation of stories that people have come up with about what this will look like. How has thinking about these issues, both prior to the birth of your son and since, influenced your writing or how you think about the function of your writing?
Well, it's definitely influenced how I think about the act of writing itself. I view those of us who have really taken up writing as a lifelong vocation, a lifelong commitment, sort of as secular clergy. We're really interested in the ways in which we can put stories together that reveal something that, you know, wasn't obvious before. And we're really, you know, sitting down every day thinking about death and meaning and beauty and morality. I was raised in a Mennonite community, and stories were sort of the most important thing. You know, I grew up having my dad tell me, you're in a different story than other people. And if you decide, you know, not to be part of the story, then that's where it ends. The story of the Mennonites, which is sort of a heavy load, but but I understood sort of the gravity of storytelling.
Boy, I have to say, I'm so thank you for sharing that. I'm so struck by the contrast between your dad saying that to you and what you said to your son. I mean, both fairly revelatory moments for a young person, I would think.
Yeah.
Yes, and I don't mean to denigrate, you know, what he was going for there, because I mean, one way of looking at that is that what he's saying to you is, Rachel, the story matters.
Absolutely. And what story do you want to write for yourself? I mean, I think that has absolutely been another question that I always carry with me. What story am I writing for myself?
That makes me think of the way that you end the essay, which gave me chills when I read it. You talk about how you have this awareness that we will die. We are powerless over that fate. But one of the phrases that you write at the end, again, quoting from the essay, is you say, we move into the future together. That's the beauty of it, the solace. And I apologize, it's actually difficult for me to read that line out loud to you. It's just so moving. And I wonder, what is the solace of that story for you?
I mean, I think togetherness is something that's so special and is not a given. During times in our lives, we will be lonely. We will feel alone. And what a gift it is to have this time together.
Well, Rachel Yoder is the author of the essay we've been discussing, which is called A Matter of Time. She's also the author of the novel Night Bitch. Rachel, thank you so much for sharing your perspective.
Thank you so much, Sam. Such a pleasure.
Good morning to you. I am Lauren Gilger, joined by Mark Brody and Sam Dingman this morning in the final day of this year-end new member drive for the station. This is the kind of thing we can bring you on public radio. That last conversation is a great example of this. These kind of in-depth conversations that go beyond the headlines, that might be something you've not heard of before, that is probably something you're not going to hear many other places. These are the conversations I think our listeners appreciate. I know I appreciate getting to do sometimes here on the show. So if you appreciate that kind of coverage, the kind of context, the kind of emotion we're able to bring you in these conversations, now is the time to show your financial support for it. Because this is how public radio is funded, by listeners who give $5, $10, $15, $20 a month, whatever amount they can afford. You're the ones who make it all happen. So we're asking you now to do your part, to go to kjzz.org and make a donation now, or call us at 888-774-9150.
We started this hour with $1,500 available to double gifts. We're a little more than halfway there with about 17 or so minutes left in the hour. Still plenty of room for you, certainly plenty of need to hear from you to keep this service strong and sustainable into the future, whether it's the news of the day, whether it's just interesting conversations with interesting people doing interesting things around our community. You get it all every single day here on the show. And it's really a unique service on public radio. You're not going to find these kinds of conversations with this kind of depth and context and nuance really anywhere else. Please make a gift right now. Have it doubled. KJZZ.org. 888-774-9150.
That's right. So we also have a little extra incentive for you if doubling your donation and supporting local news is not enough. We also are going to give everyone who gets in here at a $10 a month sustaining level, we'll get a The Show Tumblr. This is a special one. I think it's exclusive. And, you know, you can show off how smart you are, how plugged into your community you are, that you listen to local news and that you care about it. This is a good one. So $10 a month will get you that show Tumblr, plus a ticket to attend Zoo Lights at the Phoenix Zoo, one of my favorite things to do with the kids or anyone every Christmas season. So now is the time to join in, to support public radio, get that Tumblr, support the show, and you know, go to Zoo Lights. Head to KJZZ.org now or call us at 888-774-9150.
Thank you to Randy from Casa Grande, who became a monthly sustaining giver this morning. Richard in Phoenix became a member this morning. Beverly in Phoenix became a sustaining member this morning. We also heard from Amber in Goodyear, says, I like to believe that years of listening to NPR has helped improve my kids' vocabulary.
Oh, yeah.
So let us know what college they get into and how they do on the SATs.
Yes.
It'll be great.
We'll be impressed.
Whatever your reason for giving, whatever your reason for listening, we'd love to hear from you. We do hope that you will take that step, that super important step, but also a very easy step from being a listener to a supporter of public radio. It is how public radio works. You can make your gift right now. Have it doubled. KJZZ.org. 888-774-9150.
That's right. That is how public radio works. This is a nonprofit news organization. When you listen to KJZZ, you're listening to a source of news coverage that does not answer to the demands of advertisers or profit margins or ratings. This is a news service that answers to you. You're the public. That is the model here. So we need more of you. That's why we come to you every so often with these new member drives, asking you to join in, to give $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever amount you can afford to support local journalism here in the community. Nonprofit news. Head to KJZZ.org now and have that gift doubled. Help us meet this $1,500 member match, or call us, or even just text the word donate to 888-774-9150.
These drives stay short in part by meeting these hourly goals. Together, we can raise $3,000 just in this 1 hour of the show. That money goes right back into the show, into Morning Edition, into All Things Considered, helping keep this service going into the future. Make your gift right now. Have it doubled. KJZZ.org, 888-774-9150. And thanks. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. There are a whole lot of markets around town these days. Night markets, farmers markets, and this time of year, holiday markets. But our next guest is launching a new market this weekend that is even more niche. The Phoenix Fat Market. Tracy Tiwari is the founder of the community group Fat Babes of Phoenix. And she told me she chose to use the word fat for a reason. I spoke with her more about her story and why she started this group, and she told me she was part of a similar group in Denver, but couldn't find anything like it here in Phoenix, so she started it herself.
I've actually been just kind of on social media aware and involved in like the fat liberation movement and just fat community, and when I moved back to Phoenix, it was really apparent that we needed a space like that, or at least I felt like we needed a space like that here, because nothing really existed, and having been part of that both online and in other cities, I was really missing that community connection. So that's where I kind of had the motivation. I was like, all right, well, I did some looking online and didn't seem like anyone else was doing it. So you did it.
I mean, that's quite a step though. Let me back up for a moment though and ask you, Tracy, to describe what you mentioned there for us and what that means. Like you mentioned the fat liberation movement, and I'm guessing people can infer from the title there what it might mean, but this is quite a context it's in right now. Tell us about that moment and finding that and understanding what this might do for someone like you.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So I was really intentional about naming the group FAT, And I kind of went back and forth on that of, do I make it a little bit more appealing to the masses by saying, you know, plus size? But I was really intentional about using the word fat, because fat liberation is all about kind of reclaiming that word fat and destigmatizing the word fat and the negative association that society has given on that word, when really I see it and the fat liberation movement sees it as a neutral descriptor. Huh. So it's all about reclaiming that word, advancing fat acceptance, you know, trying to promote body neutrality, creating community where we can talk to each other about the things that we experience in the medical field, in society, in life, because of weight, you know, weight discrimination, negative things that we experience being in larger bodies.
Yeah. So that makes it sound serious and a little heavy, a little down, right? But it sounds like what you're doing with Fat Babes of Phoenix is really uplifting.
Yeah, absolutely. Our biggest thing is fat joy. So we love saying like our fat joy. We want to celebrate fat joy. We want to uplift fat joy. We just want to exist as a fat community without it being something that we're trying to hide from, or that we're trying to pretend that we're not fat, because it almost feels like in society that's what we have to do. Huh. And so it's really just about, you know, let's just exist as a group of fat people who are just fat, and we're people, and we do fun things, and we celebrate, and we enjoy. And it doesn't have to be about us being fat, but the fact that we are fat gives us that automatic sense of community and that we can relate to each other on that level.
That's so interesting. So talk a little bit about what this was like when you first started forming these groups. Like, it started small, like there was a clothing swap, but like a pool party, right? Like, what kinds of things did you hear from the folks who showed up?
Yeah, so we started like with doing park meetups, and that was just kind of a way of like, okay, well, try to get some people to just meet up and just be able to talk and meet other people. And the things people were saying were things like, I'm so glad that I found this community. I've needed this so badly. Or to be able to show up to something without being as nervous or scared that I'm going to be the largest person in the group and everyone's going to be looking at me. And so just being able to remove that barrier, and people have just, when we had our pool party, it was so special because everyone just kept saying that, wow, this is the first time I've ever been around this many people with bodies that look like mine or large bodies. And it was just a really freeing, belonging feeling.
That's really cool. Can you tell us a little bit about your own personal kind of journey in this? Like, how did you come across the fat liberation movement and start to embrace it?
Yeah, I would say I've always struggled with my body image. I have been quote unquote overweight my entire life. And constantly went through the battle of diets and trying to be smaller and losing weight, gaining weight. And I came to this realization where I would look back on photos of myself where I was smaller. And the one thing I realized was my mindset at the time was the exact same. My body might have been smaller, but I still in my mind thought I needed to be smaller in order to fit into what society says we're supposed to look like. And that was the moment where I really realized, like, I just want to like not even think about that. And there's a lot online and social media about body positivity.
Right.
And so definitely was involved in that aspect of it. But as you kind of get more involved and really dig into like, why can't we, you know, find simple accommodations, like being able to just have seats that are comfortable for people of all body sizes. And then as you dig more into that, you get more into what is like the fat liberation or things that people are doing to break down anti-fat discrimination and things like that. So it really started with this just like, oh, I'm body positive and I love myself regardless of my size. But just developed more into even more freeing and let go of even that.
Yeah.
To go beyond.
Yeah. Let me ask you about something that you're getting at there and that I think ties into the market that you're holding this weekend, which is this idea of accessibility, right? I wonder how much of a barrier that is for people in fat bodies, and one that probably most people don't even think about.
Yeah, I think you exactly summarize by saying like one that people don't think about. I think something as simple as chairs, whether it be in a restaurant, in a doctor's office, you know, wherever you're going, someone who exists in a thin or smaller body probably never even thinks about, oh, am I going to get to the doctor's office and fit into the chair in the waiting room or not? Someone who exists in a bigger body, those are things that we experience. And for me, it's even more than the chair itself. It's more of a, it's the feeling of not fitting. And it's not that chair. It's like overall, you constantly feel like you don't fit into society, into this mold. And it's just, it can put someone into a really negative place. And I don't think people understand the bigger impact that that can have on someone rather than it just being as simple as a chair.
So tell us about this market this weekend. I mean, this is like, markets are kind of everywhere right now and they're getting very niche. This is definitely one of them. Where did the need come up for this?
Yeah, so I love going to markets. And as I would meet more people in the community, something that kept coming up was someone would say, oh, I make zines, or oh, I sell jewelry, or I have a plus size clothing where I rework clothing and make it plus size and make it accessible. And it was like, these things kept coming up. And I was like, wait a minute, we have this awesome group of people, super creative people. And, you know, just seeing how many markets and things there are out there, it just seemed like, let's do one ourselves. And also, as someone who goes to markets, I can never go to a market and expect to find clothing for sure. No, I mean, I'll go and I'll be like, okay, jewelry, things like that. But the idea of having a market where people could actually find plus size clothing is just so special, because that just never happened.
All right, we'll leave it there. Tracy Tiwari, founder of Fat Babes of Phoenix, joining us to talk about the market coming up this weekend that the group is putting on. Tracy, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us your story and talking about this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate talking to you.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.